Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So this evening's the new moon, lunar observance night. Opportunity to listen to Dhamma, practice the teachings. The opportunity to consciously reflect on kind of simplicity. That's say a lot of what say when we take precepts. It's an opportunity to rely on skillful means for simplifying our life and keeping a focus for our spiritual effort. Many of the just the ways that we relate to the world around us inevitably end up complicating our lives, and particularly on there's different ways of looking at the precepts, but particularly on the observance days to be taking on a training for a day and a night, and using a framework of simplicity and focus. That's really what precepts help us to do, particularly in context of refuges. It helps to in that simplification helps us to really dwell or rely on the things which make a refuge. And from a Buddhist perspective, the Buddha as a symbol of wisdom, of compassion, the Dhamma as the teachings or the framework of training, and Sangha as a recollection of virtue, purity, that we have this opportunity to make these qualities a refuge in the heart, and to train in ways that help support that. And of course, a simplicity in our actions and speech are an important support for creating a refuge, so that a skillful way of relating to precepts is recognizing that it's a support for training. When we let's say determine the precepts, the word sikha padang is sort of literally translated a basis for training, a basis for study, education even. And so that educating ourselves in ways that allow us to rely on kind of an inner peace and inner clarity. These are because these are things that we need to train in. And I think for most of us, when we're confronted with a situation, oftentimes our first option isn't to opt for peace and wisdom. It's usually for more complication and agitation. So that having skillful means of training ourselves to be able to make that choice, and that's really what in terms terms of a spiritual path, learning how to make wise and skillful choices. We've begun our winter retreat, and this last 5-6 days, we've been having group practice, and I've given reflections most mornings, and putting a lot of attention on what are called the 5 hindrances. And these are the hindrances, obstructions, those things which overwhelm awareness and weaken discernment. So those are the aspects of sense desire or sensual desire, that being pulled into that seeking of gratification through the senses, stimulation, ill will, aversion, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and skeptical doubt. Those are the 5 habits of mind that the Buddha points to that are hindrances. And to be able to find a skillful means to work with and overcome or to transform those habits into something that is beneficial and useful to us. What supports awareness and strengthens discernment. Those are helpful things. And just by being able to take note of and to recognize how those tendencies work in the mind is a big step in being able to deal with them. One of the fundamental kind of root habits of the mind that keeps pulling us back to discontent, dissatisfaction, confusion. The Buddha points to the Pali word, the scriptural word is avijja. And oftentimes it's translated as ignorance, but it's not a great term, because the word literally means, a lack of true knowledge. So that when we lack true knowledge of a situation, lack true knowledge of the mind and its moods, its feelings, then we tend to set in motion a series of causes and conditions that lands us up in a sense of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. That's the words that the Buddha uses. The different ways that suffering manifests, and whether it's just some niggling little discontent, or whether it's some major bout of despair, it's all under the umbrella of what the Buddha says is dukkha, is suffering. And and the fundamental cause, or kind of that sets this chain of conditions in motion, is always pointed to, the Buddha always points to to this avijja, this lack of true knowledge. And oftentimes when that teaching is laid out, this dependent origination causal conditioning process, it oftentimes appears as this sort of first cause of ignorance, of lack of true knowledge, and we'll oftentimes relate to it or assume somehow that that's kind of the baseline condition in the human realm, is that we're stuck with this fundamental ignorance that we're always defer to, and it's not actually how the Buddha lays it out. That's sort of a structure of a particular teaching, and it is a root problem, but that also relies on causes and conditions, that this lack of true knowledge, this avijja, ignorance, comes into being because of particular conditions. And when the Buddha traces it back, and the direct causal conditioning process that supports that ignorance, that avijja, is the five hindrances. And five hindrances end up being supported by just a wrong grasp of our sensory contact. So that to be able to lift up that experience of these five hindrances, and to be able to identify clearly, is a very direct means of undermining that lack of true knowledge, that ignorance, giving us the opportunity to very directly influence things in a positive direction for establishing understanding, discernment, and awareness. So that these habits of mind it's helpful to have skillful means for working with. And once one identifies it, the mind is getting swept up in some kind of attraction to sensual desire, sensual gratification, and it's sort of my happiness and well-being is completely dependent on my getting this. Whether it's this thing or this experience or this feeling, it's still that perception of me being lacking something, and the means of satisfaction, gratification is out there, and of course that's putting oneself in a kind of a position of poverty, a lack, a feeling of lack. To be able to particularly the way how the Buddha cast an antidote is to be able to reflect on the nature of the body, in the sense that usually, particularly around that sense of sensual, sensory, sense realm gratification tends to be based on our physical body, what we can gain through sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, to take a different perspective, rather than looking on the body as a vehicle for gratification, just recognizing its impermanent nature, and saying, yeah, the physical body subject to aging, sickness, death. And these are so that there's a sobering quality that is another picture, another image, rather than the vehicle of gratification. It's something that is fraught with these realities, and to not waste time, not to dissipate one's opportunity for skillfulness, for peace. Recollecting the actual composition of the body, rather than it sort of being all of a piece of the body being a vehicle for gratification, satisfaction, stimulation, and sort of just going through it as the body and being this collection of various parts that fit together, work together, have to have to be created and built out of these parts. So the classic recollection, going through the body, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin, which is an interesting contemplation. You think on one level, you think, oh, hair of the body, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin. You know, what's that mean? But then you start reflecting, actually, you know, what we perceive of as, whether it's our own body or other people's bodies, that's actually all we see. Hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin. I mean, that's actually it. And we don't usually think of that, looking at other people, but in reality, that it's just that basic. To be able to bring it up in as a reflection, because it really changes one's perception. And then the contemplations go on to sort of looking through the under the skin and sort of flesh, sinews, bones, organs, fluids, and it has a tendency to there's a sobering tendency, which is helpful, because the nature of desire is that it always looks on what's desirable. I mean, it's function. To be looking, presenting another picture that says, oh, there's this other unattractive element, this aspect that is... And when one looks at it in that way, there's a kind of a cooling and soothing element that helps one to settle. And it's a particular antidote to that compulsion towards desire and gratification. And it's important to recognize that these are tools to accomplish a particular purpose. It's not about making either a value judgment or a moral judgment about the nature of the body. Or even the nature of desire. It's just sort of desire that is focused on gratification in and of itself is usually not actually seeing the big picture. And it's only when we're able to come back to a place where we're able to cool those aspects of compulsion towards gratification, that we can start to see more clearly, and so say that sense of supporting awareness and fostering discernment, so that we're able to look at things clearly. And the other, another hindrance, of course, of aversion, ill will. And aversion, ill will has a different kind of habit or different pattern. Rather than it picking up on the desirable elements and the elements of either person, situation, or oneself, it focuses in on the things that it finds irritating, upsetting, aggravating. And the mind gets overwhelmed or gets swept up in those aspects of aversion, ill will, anger, the mind is awareness is overwhelmed and discernment is weakened, so that to be able to balance. And to not be caught by that hook of ill will, seeing the faults, the flaws, the things that are upsetting or difficult about a situation or a person, and so the antidote to classically is to cultivating loving kindness, so that one is. In order to be able to kind of override or not to be pulled into negative perceptions that tend to create suffering, agitation. The mind is not peaceful. It's not clear when we're swept up in aversion. And it may be that it, you know, one is you know, on one level it may even be a correct assessment of somebody or something or some situation, but when we're swept up in ill will and aversion, then the mind is not settled. It's not clear, and we tend to make choices and make judgments that end up being detrimental to our well-being in the long run. So that to be able to, and the function of loving kindness is not to just sort of sugarcoat everything and make it all kind of sort of beautiful, pleasant, but it's to be able to not dwell in ill will, to be able to, and a better translation maybe of loving kindness is like well wishing, so that to wish somebody well, to spread loving kindness to them doesn't necessarily mean you even have to like them, but it's just that one isn't wishing harm for somebody. One isn't wishing that that they suffer and they're miserable. It has this sense of well-wishing if somebody were truly happy, they would make very different choices with their lives. So that sense of for oneself and for others we function a lot better when we establish ourselves in that sense of well-being that arises through a relinquishing of ill will, a relinquishing of aversion. So that directing of an establishing of loving kindness. And of course the first person that we direct loving kindness towards is ourselves. And that's the foundation of the cultivation of loving kindness, that as with one of the chants that we do on a regular basis of the may I abide in well-being, to be able to internalize that sincere wish for well-being. This is a thought, emotion that we all share as human beings, and oftentimes it's not articulated or it's not focused on clearly enough. So the conscious development of an antidote to ill will, to aversion as a hindrance, is that conscious development of the aspects of metta, of loving kindness. Sometimes when we use the terms of loving kindness, or another translation, loving friendliness. I mean, it's a hard one to translate, but that sense of Ajahn Sumedho emphasizes it a lot in terms of just learning how to not dwell in ill will, finding the tools and finding that setting up that intention not dwelling in aversion. The third hindrance that the Buddha points to is one of sloth and torpor. And when the Buddha is pointing to these things that are hindrances in our practice, in our meditation, in our living a life of cultivation, it's those things that when the Buddha is saying that overwhelms awareness and weakens discernment. Again, it's not sort of in a kind of a moralistic sense, but it's like, what is it that clouds the mind? What is it that obstructs the mind? What is it that blocks the heart from seeing things clearly. And that quality of sloth and torpor is a a quality to that kind of being either being swept up or drawn into those aspects of dullness and kind of turgid qualities of mind, where the mind just sort of sinks, and it's not buoyed up by awareness or mindfulness or a kind of quality of brightness. And to be able to consciously cultivate bright states of mind to counter that the habit. And you know, different people have, in all of these hindrances, we all have different habits or propensities or favorite hindrances. But to be able to recognize for oneself what are our habits? Where does the mind tend to go to? So that those qualities of sloth and torpor, when one recognizes that the mind starting to drift, the mind starting to get unclear, then to be able to brighten, be able to find ways of brightening the mind, so that when the Buddha gives instruction on dealing with that tendency to dullness, is just clarifying the meditation object, whatever meditation object one is using, just to clarify it, so that the Buddha in his teachings, gave many different types of meditation instruction, and some of them are very ordinary and common, the mindfulness of breathing, or the development of the unattractive nature of the body, or loving kindness meditation, or recollections of of the refuges, meditation objects like color, or the physical elements. I mean, it doesn't really matter what meditation object one is using, but whatever one's doing, if the mind is starting to drift and become unclear and dull, to lift up that meditation object so that it becomes clear in the mind. Lifting it up and taking the posture in terms of both the not just sort of lifting up as a mental act, but lifting physically, lifting up the physical posture, so that one is straightening the posture, lifting up the body, lifting up the mind, so that things become energized and clear. And as one pays attention to that, oftentimes that's enough for the mind to sort of become clear, and then to reestablish the mindfulness of the meditation that one has been developing. And sometimes when we're sitting meditation and It's, you know, so you get, you know, it depends where you're meditating, but sometimes, you know, you get nice and cozy and put a nice blanket around you and get a nice pillow for you, get sitting really comfortable and just wrapped up nice and warm. And you and then all of a sudden you find yourself drowsy and sleepy. So that's where, say, I mean, I spent a lot of time in Thailand in the tropics, and tropical heat is, that's really good for drowsiness and sleepiness. Being in a cooler climate to make sure that you're not too warm. It helps that sloth and torpor is not being too warm, too comfortable. And it's interesting that you know, because what we're pointing out with dealing with the hindrances is really around balance, so that to deal with sloth and torpor, then you don't want to get too comfortable. But to deal with like restlessness and agitation, you don't want to make yourself too uncomfortable. So that, you know, paying attention to what the particular hindrance, how it's coming up, what are the triggers for that, and finding the both external and internal ways of adapting and adjusting. You know, in the same way that, say, like sensual desire and ill will, there's kind of they're kind of two opposites of how the mind reacts to the circumstances around it. One is sort of is going out in terms of kind of getting and experiencing it, and the other is just pushing away and I don't have anything to do with this. One needs to have a balance in the mind that is helping to come back on track so that there can be a sustaining foundation in awareness and discernment, mindfulness and investigation. These are the qualities that one wants to be supporting. The sense of tranquility and awareness and steadiness and investigation. Kind of tranquility, investigation, with an awareness and clarity in the middle. And these are like two wings of a bird or something, where it needs these both wings to get anywhere. And similar, our mind, the heart, needs to have this quality of balance, of tranquility, of steadiness, of investigation, discernment. And there's that quality of awareness and mindfulness that is in the middle, recognizing, looking for areas of balance, so that sloth and torpor, the mind tends to dullness, it tends to sink, and so that you know, physically lifting up the posture, lifting up the meditation object. Sometimes with the meditation object, it starts to become, you know, the mind is drifting. That's where it's like reviewing sort of more discursive aspects of the teachings, bringing up from memory a particular teaching that helps one to reestablish a connection with the practice, bringing up a teaching that arouses a sense of commitment and energy. There's one of the reflections that the Buddha gives for particularly for monastics. It applies to everybody, but days and nights are relentlessly passing. How well am I spending my time? It's just as a phrase that one can be bringing up to sort of arousing the mind, encouraging the mind. The Buddha's sort of admonition on his deathbed that Dhamma Sankara, all phenomena are impermanent, changing. Establish a sense of circumspection, of clarity in one's practice. It's a short teaching that sort of gives it encapsulates so many teachings, and it's encouraging, it's arousing, and that's the kind of sort of thing that one is using when to counter the tendency to sloth and torpor. Also, just the Buddha, if one's meditating at night. Say like tonight's a lunar observance night, and there's a vigil tonight, so that people who are practicing, finding it, sitting in the hall, having maybe sloth and torpor, going outside and looking at the stars, getting out into fresh air. Brings up, it arouses the mind. Sometimes also with we sometimes feel committed to sitting meditation. It's all the pictures of meditation, sitting somewhere in cross-legged position. But the Buddha didn't sort of say that one had to sit all the time. It was because often, there's idioms that are used of say rather than going on a retreat. So he's going to sit a retreat, and say, well, you think you might be doing some walking, standing, and lying down as well. But it's that sense of we identify meditation with sitting, and the Buddha said, no, it's all four postures. That ability to apply mindfulness and attention to free the mind from the hindrances in any posture that we're in. So that sometimes it's a lot more useful to be doing walking meditation and being mindful and having a continuity of awareness than, say, sitting in where one's dull or distracted. So that finding the means by which one is able to establish a continuity of awareness and attention and that's up to each of us to be figuring that out, experimenting, seeing what works, seeing what doesn't work, seeing what worked last week doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work this week, and so that taking that sense of interest in the practice, interest in how to skillfully work with those qualities that overwhelm awareness and weaken discernment. And it's developing that skill is the application of wisdom. Restlessness and worry, these are another hindrance that the Buddha points to. And that's where one pays attention to sort of qualities that are really objects of attention that are really calming. The breath is one just paying attention to the rhythm of the breath, paying attention to it in sort of a non-discursive way, letting the mind be soothed and settled by the rhythm of the breath coming in and going out. And that's an antidote to that restlessness and worry. If one's having difficulty with dullness and drowsiness, and then one sort of peacefully settles into the rhythm of the breath going in and out, it's usually not going to work. But if there's kind of restlessness and anxiety, then you want to take a really soothing object. The breath is one. Sometimes visualizing a really peaceful image of the Buddha, just bringing to mind that a particular Buddha image that really has those connotations of peace and tranquility. Just a visualization, finding an object that the mind is soothed and settled by. So helping the mind to settle its restlessness, its worry and anxiety. Aspects of skeptical doubt. It's interesting when the Buddha gives a kind of antidotes to skeptical doubt, that there's most of them are more external means in the sense of association with good friends in good friends in the Dhamma, hearing teachings give one a sense of confidence and clarity. So that was sort of more external. For myself, I've found one of the ways of dealing with that kind of doubt, wavering, uncertainty, is coming back to the physical body, physical sensation. Especially when the mind's overwhelmed with doubt and uncertainty, going to the mind itself and trying to sort of figure it out, it just ends up a whole mush of uncertainty and doubt. So that going back to the body, going back to just physical sensation, touch. The feeling of tension or relaxation in the body, the actual consciously relaxing and soothing the kind of different knots of wavering and uncertainty, and just that sense of relaxing and touching in with the physical body, having an anchor for experience. In physical sensation, is being able to develop that as an object tends to give a bridge to get past the tendency to wavering and uncertainty. So that these are all skillful means, tools to learn how to use. And to recognize that any tool that you have depends on the skill of the person who's wielding that tool, so that learning how, taking the opportunity to really learn how to apply these different sort of encouragements and advice that the Buddha or other teachers give, but then picking it up for oneself and developing a sense of familiarity and understanding of how to apply the tools. How does it feel like when it works? When that particular hindrance is sort of drops away, and there's a sense of clarity and settling. What happens when it doesn't work? The mind continues to get swept up in these sort of unwholesome, unskillful states of mind, states of being, and recognizing that it's not so much about sort of success or failure. It's about developing skill and developing understanding of how the mind works, and how to develop the means whereby we can really encourage the heart in its aspiration for clarity and understanding. So that these are some tools to reflect on tonight. Offer that.